Hello and welcome to Stepping into Truth. I'm your host, Omkari Williams, and I'm very happy to have you here with me today. This is the podcast where we have conversations on race, gender, and social justice. If you're interested in doing a deeper dive on these subjects or in supporting this podcast, I invite you to join my Patreon community. You can find me at patreon.com/Omkari Williams, and there's a link in the episode notes. Today, I'm really excited to have as my guest someone whose work I've been following for about a decade, Patty Dye. Patty Dye has written 8 books on global diversity and living mindfully, has worked and traveled in over 60 countries, has served on the President's Committee on the Employment of People with Disabilities, and has learned more from her transgender autistic son than from any of those other experiences. Patty is the founder of The Art of Activism and Life is a Verb Camp, and is currently working on writing a book on the history of normalcy with her husband, John Putak. So, Patty, welcome. I'm so happy that you're here.
I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. So I've already said that I've been a fan for a while, and I have a number of your books. And the thing that I've probably loved most about all the work that you do is your relationship to story. It's my belief that story is foundational and that story is the bridge between people. And I'd love to hear about the place that story holds in your life and worldview.
Sure. I have often said that the shortest distance between two people is a story. And I think that a lot of times we disregard the fact that when we're talking about diversity, inclusion, and social justice, we're really talking about the quality of engagement between human beings. And in this case, I think story, as you said, is the bridge between those two. I grew up in a Southern family. So if you ask my mother, you know, how Aunt Esteline is doing, she's first going to tell you the history of pimento cheese, and then she'll finally get to Aunt Esteline. Very, very Southern storytelling tradition where things are passed through story. And I think, you know, we believe we're made up of atoms, but I truly believe we're made up of stories, and that stories are the mechanism by which we make meaning of our lives. We're constantly storying everything. And it was interesting when one of my books came out, Life is a Verb, which is very much based on story. I had a lot of people say, I don't have stories like that. And my response was, you do. You're just not paying attention to them. They're very small moments in your life that become bigger stories if we hold them and honor them and tell them. And I think we disregard that. We're waiting for the large Chicago musical kind of approach.
Yes.
But my stories are really small stories. There's one about my smallest child carrying around a little grape that he just loved and carried around for a long time. And in that story, I think we find things that are universal about what's precious to us. And so it becomes bigger by the meaning that we invest in it and invest in that grape. But it's all too easy to feel like, well, our stories are not that powerful or they're not that important. I remember one time I was doing a speech in Austin, and I looked at the website of the organization before I left and said to my husband, oh my God, the opening speaker before me is a woman who rode a solo across the Atlantic. And he said, that's great. I said, what do you mean that's great? She's going to have all these big stories about eating bugs and living through storms and, you know, all this big stuff. And here I'm going to be with my story about a grape. And he listened to me and he just said, I had no idea this was a competition.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
That's absolutely perfect, because it's true. I mean, I experience that so often in my work with people, is they feel like, well, my story's just so small and insignificant, mm-hmm. as if someone else's story is inherently more worthwhile. And it isn't a competition. And it is how we make sense of the world. And that right there seems to me like enough reason to pay attention to our stories, because they give us so much information when we are paying attention to them. So, yeah.
The piece of it is that we don't understand that that what we're telling ourselves is also a story. You know, when we're telling ourselves my story is too small, or I'm too insignificant to make a difference, or all those messages that we tell ourselves, those are also stories. And we invest in all of these false stories a lot, and they become blocks for us. They become ways that we circumvent doing what we're meant to do in the world by listening to the stories that we're telling ourselves, or listening to the stories that other people are telling about us. You know?
Yes. And I think we also forget often that other people's stories are actually less about us often than they are about the people who are telling the stories.
Absolutely.
And that's something to be aware of also when we tell stories about others is, what is this actually about for me? Because I'm the storyteller here, so I'm making this up in my own head. And I don't mean making up in the sense of lying. I mean just in the sense of creation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a really good point. Thank you for that. I want to switch gears here a bit because, and then sort of come back and pull these threads together. You were the founding vice president of international and diversity programs for the Society for Human Rights Management. And I'd like to ask you what led you to that work.
It was the Society for Human Resource Management.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I wish it had been the Society for Human Rights Management. That would have been a lot more on the edge. What led me to that work was I had done in my youth a lot of international work. And so when this position for an international person came open, I thought that would be fun. And it was not a program for the organization at the time. I founded both the International Institute for SHRM and also the diversity programs for SHRM, because I knew that there were a lot of HR people around the world, really, who were looking for, particularly regarding the diversity work, who were looking for really good resources in a field that at the time was not all that known. You know, there were just a few people who were doing good work in the area of diversity work. And of course, anybody who was in an HR role needed to be aware of that, you know, needed to be looking at those issues. But I won't say it was an easy sell, because at the time, this is in the 80s, you know, a lot of people were like, well, this is not that important an issue. So you can see how that's changed in the last 30 years or so. But unfortunately, we're still having the same conversations we had 30 years ago about these issues. And there's a part of me that is frustrated with that lack of forward momentum. At the same time, I can realize that we have made changes. Of course, now it feels like we're in retrograde, but you know, changes have been made. And that work really gave me a view into primarily corporate America, looking at, well, what are corporations thinking about and doing relative to diversity? And I could tell that the organizations that were looking at this issue were doing it because of pain or vision or a combination of those two things. And a lot of times it was pain induced. You know, they were being sued, for example, and needed to do something, quote unquote, about diversity and inclusion, which is a hard mindset to help with, because, you know, there's definitely different layers of how we change things inside organizations. If you know Paul Watzlawick's book on change, he talks a lot about first and second order change. And what I saw from a lot of the HR people I was dealing with was, we just need first order change. We just need to mark this off our to-do list and say that we did it so that we satisfy what the court is asking us to do. And that work was not ever satisfying to me, because I didn't feel like it was looking at the structure of the organization and really making substantive changes that would be sustainable for the organization. So that's the work that I then evolved into after I left SHRM, was helping organizations look at this from a much more sustainable point of view.
That's really interesting, because, you know, especially this week, this is the week after the Blasey Ford Kavanaugh hearings regarding the confirmation of Kavanaugh to the court, which is still up in the air. But looking at that hearing, And then thinking back to the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings and looking at how little has actually substantively changed in some ways in the intervening couple of decades plus. And it's to me, it reminds me all the time of how tenaciously we humans can hold on to things.
Oh, sure.
That do not necessarily support us and that are not necessarily in our best interests, but they are familiar and we will hold on for dear life. So I can only imagine that working in an organization where you are trying to instill really meaningful models of diversity and inclusion, not just, oh, we have two women. Oh, we have two Black people in the room. Oh, we have an Hispanic and an Asian person, that working in a way that made that meaningful must have been really challenging. What was the challenge that you most often encountered?
Oh, it's still challenging.
Oh, and I am an eternal optimist. Okay.
Well, here's the thing. I talk a lot about the structure of the land. And let me just tell you this analogy, because I think it makes sense for what we're talking about. You know, if you go into the mountains, I live in the mountains of North Carolina. If you go in the mountains here, you'll see that water follows the structure of the land. And now it's created that structure over a long time. But for the sake of this analogy, let's just say the water follows the structure of the land. And it will always do that. You know, if the structure of the land changes, then the water will flow in a different way. You can see this when you dam up a river, for example. And water like water, follows the path of least resistance. It also follows the structure of the land. So I can take, you know, hundreds of people into a training process that gives them new skills and new behaviors that would be more inclusive, for example. But then I plop them back into an organization whose structure of the land has not changed at all. So their behavior can move in that new direction for a short period of time. But, you know, after just a short time, it will go back to follow the structure of the land that's in place. So an example would be, I was called in to do some work with an organization where, you know, everywhere you looked in the organization were those successory posters with people rowing together, you know? And everybody said, you know, teamwork is our number one priority. And they had little mouse pads that said that and t-shirts. And so it was a big deal for them that teamwork was their priority. But when you looked at their compensation system, it was all based on individual merit. So the structure of the land is individual merit, and there's only so much that you can do with the behavior of people in the land, you know, that they won't, they'll go right back to following individual merit. And that's a challenge, because I want organizations to see a fuller, deeper picture of what they're doing. And in large part, I think what they're doing is they're looking at what in computer language you would call a wicked problem, a problem that is deeply rooted in a lot of different fields, socioeconomic, all kinds of different things have influence on these issues having to do with diversity. And yet we continue to apply tame solutions to those problems. And a tame solution not only doesn't solve it, it just makes it worse. So an example is I got a call just a few years ago, unfortunately, from a manufacturing company in North Carolina, saying, we have a problem. We have white employees putting nooses on the lockers of Black employees. Can you help?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I said, you know, I do a lot of stuff around racism. I'm happy to help. What did you have in mind? And the answer stopped me. It actually stopped me doing the work for a little bit while I regained my equilibrium. What he said was, I think maybe a 1 or 2 hour training program. Now, this, for nooses, this is, you know, if I could do this work in 1 or 2 hours and change people's minds and the structure of that land, I would absolutely be doing that every hour of every day. The truth is, you can't. And to bring in somebody from the outside to do a 1 or 2 hour training program on such a deeply rooted issue, as you can understand, doesn't solve it. It makes it worse.
Yeah. Absolutely, because then people feel like, well, we've addressed this and surely it's going to be better. And it just completely fits in with their predisposition to feel like there's a simple solution to something. That
this is not an issue that is that has solutions. You know, I think that's one of the things that I try and address with a lot of organizations and people in organizations. I talk a lot about these three kinds of problems that we run into. One is simple. You know, a simple problem you handle every day, how to dial your phone, how to make a cake, when to put gas in your car. You don't have to think about these things. You just do it. A complicated problem is the second kind, and that's like a moon launch. It's a lot more moving parts. You need more expertise, a lot more Excel spreadsheets, but it can be done. You can actually do that if you have everything in place. And the third kind of problem is a complex problem. And a complex problem is raising a child. No amount of math or Excel spreadsheets will help you with that, because you're dealing with a real live human being. And the same is true for diversity and inclusion work. And the challenge is that most people who call me in want to look at it as if it's merely complicated, but it's not, it's complex. And anytime you're dealing with other human beings, there's a complexity involved. It's not solvable. You simply walk toward the complexity and engage with it in a different way, in a healthier way. And I think these kinds of deeper philosophical groundings have to be in place. Otherwise, we're just putting frosting on top of something that hasn't changed, won't change, and will make it impossible for people to change.
I think that that's actually something that I experience as a systemic problem in our society, is that I'm specifically saying Americans, we like to feel like there's a quick and easy answer to every challenge that confronts us.
Right.
And when we can't find a quick and easy answer, what we tend to do is just turn away. We stop looking at the problem because we're so deeply uncomfortable. And I think that that's part of how this whole system that exists right now has been sustained for such a long period of time. Besides the fact that it definitely benefits some people, the people that it doesn't benefit look away and they just sort of throw their hands up and say, well, this is the way it is. This is the way it's always been. This is the way it's always going to be. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think we're educated to deal in complexity.
No, we're not.
And to me, that's an enormous problem in our society, because once we stop being critical thinkers, which is what I think complexity requires, then we are completely at the mercy of those who have a very clear worldview and are willing to just follow it no matter what. And no matter
who it hurts. And then it's usually based on false binaries.
Yes.
That worldview. And there's, you know, there's so much systems thinking and systems work around false binaries that just lead you to the precipice on which we find ourselves. You know, you cannot sustain a culture that's based on false binaries. It's impossible to do. And yet in the last year or two, we've gone further in that direction than we ever have been. In my experience, of life in this country. And I think it can't be sustainable. We can't survive with this kind of up, down, good, bad, black, white kind of binary.
I agree. And again, here's where my endless optimism comes in. I am hopeful that this is the sort of tipping point, that we are sort of, that there's this retrenchment that is happening, and that we will move ourselves out of it, because things can't sustain like this, but that it's going to get worse before it gets better. Hopefully,
seems impossible.
Hopefully the better part starts to come at some point, because it's getting kind of grim here, but we shall see. So something I noticed when I was doing my research for this podcast was that you started what you call the School of Inclusion. And this was, if I'm remembering correctly, this was in response to the murder of 9 African Americans in a Charleston, South Carolina church by a young white man whom they had welcomed into their prayer meeting.
Right.
And I would really like to hear about the School of Inclusion, what that mission is, and how that program works, because it just struck me so powerfully that that was one of the loveliest responses to that tragedy that I had come across.
Oh, well, thank you. A friend of mine called it my summer of rage. So the rage at the responses that I saw on my Facebook wall was really the catalyst, you know, along with the event, the catalyst for, it's called the School of Inclusion and Activism, because I really wanted people, I wanted to mentor and build activists as well as teach people about inclusion. But it came out of a lot of comments on my Facebook page that were something like this. I'm not sure that had anything to do with race, or I'm colorblind, I don't see race. And I seriously was enraged. And I decided that I could either be enraged, which was probably not good for my health, or I could try and teach people some things. And so late in July of that summer, I put together a 4-week curriculum called An Introduction to Racism. And I thought maybe 50 people would sign up. It's an online class. I thought maybe 50 people would sign up, and 3,500 people signed up.
That's amazing.
It gave me great hope.
You know,
it really was the boost that I needed to realize there are good people in this world, and they want to do, quote unquote, the right thing, even though there are problems with that phrase. I just was so heartened by the response, and the conversation in the class was extraordinary. So it has continued. That class is now in its 13th or 14th cohort. We've trained about 12,000 people as a part of that process, and are now expanding the offerings, because it occurred to me, having done a lot of in-person training in corporations, that there's a whole group of people who are interested in this, but who never, because they're not in those corporations, they never have access to high quality training on these issues. So the online format makes it possible to reach people that I probably would never otherwise reach in a corporate setting or in a nonprofit setting, which is where I do a lot of my work. So the online format has brought people. There was a woman after the first class who said, "I'm 75. I've learned so much. I just wish I had taken this when I was 35. You know, that's somebody I wouldn't necessarily reach in the work that I usually do, whether it's speeches or workshops. So I think it has great potential to be kind of a hub for really good quality work on a number of issues. We're putting together a course now on the theory behind social justice work, because if you don't know what the grounding is for the work that you're doing, in hot moments, you don't know where to turn. So really looking at, I'm a former philosophy person, so really looking at the philosophy and the theory behind the work in order to be able to speak intelligently from a deeper perspective than just the behavioral change, which I think is at the surface.
I really appreciate that, because, well, there are a couple of things I really appreciate. So the first thing is that you included the word activism, because it doesn't help anyone if this is simply an intellectual concept.
Right.
We need to actually go out and live these concepts and speak about these concepts and engage with people around the ideas and the experiences that we're having. So I really appreciate that. And I also appreciate that, as you say, this is now something that can reach people you would not otherwise be able to reach. And one of the things I love about the internet, because I dislike many things about the internet, but I really appreciate that opportunity to engage with people across the world, or even just across town, who you would not otherwise get to know and be able to make an impact on each other's lives. On the flip side of that, I think that too often in this whole conversation on race and social justice, now we're getting kind of siloed. And it can be, even with people who consider themselves to be allies of one another, it can get kind of nasty online.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, a friend of mine describes it as the woke Olympics that she sees going on. I know, I love that phrase. It just made me laugh so hard.
Well, the other side of that is the oppression Olympics. You know, we have both of those things going on, I think, at the same time. And neither one of them is healthy.
No, at all, at all. So I really appreciate what the School of Inclusion and Activism, I appreciate the message there. And I appreciate that it's an opportunity for people to look at their way of interacting with these very important mm-hmm. concepts and behaviors in an online setting, so they don't actually have to go anywhere. They can do this on their own from home. And I think that's so important as we try and expand these conversations out. So thank you so much for that.
Yeah, let me say one other thing. I think one of the things I'm proudest of with that school is that each of the classes sets the stage really deeply for how we're going to have this conversation, so that the conversation is challenging and brave and respectful and acknowledges the fact that not everybody is starting the conversation from the same perspective, obviously, because we all come to it from very different backgrounds. But I think we do a really good job of saying, here's some tools that will help you listen to what people have to say who are saying things that are different from your own reality. And I think that's really necessary. I know when I do in-person training, sometimes clients will give me grief for spending so much time on safety building and space building. But I think there's a need for us to be able to also look at how we're having these conversations in addition to having the conversations themselves.
I agree completely. I'm actually right now doing a book group with a bunch of people, and I'm the only person of color in the group, and it's a pretty large group. Mm-hmm. And they invited me specifically, excuse me, because they wanted my perspective. But it's very interesting being the only person of color in a group talking about a book that is about racism and white supremacy and dismantling those concepts, and how does mm-hmm. one go about doing that. And when you talk about safety, I realize that for me, that experience, the only reason I can be in that group is because I know these people.
Mm-hmm.
That otherwise I would have said no, because it wouldn't have felt safe. And mm-hmm. I'm a pretty feisty, sturdy character, mm-hmm. but there's still a level at which, as a Black woman in the United States in the 21st century, I am very aware of being vulnerable to attack.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it's so important that you said that, because I do think that that's true. And I think often people of color, we kind of go through our day and we don't think about that aspect of our lives consciously, but it's always there in the background, that safety aspect. So mm-hmm. I really appreciate that you addressed that in these groups that you're leading.
Yeah, and it's made a big difference in terms of where, excuse me, where the group can actually go with their conversation.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Yeah. And it's, and that brings us back to story, because what people are doing in these groups is sharing their stories.
Exactly.
And it's why I am completely convinced that story is the baseline for pretty much everything we do. And if we want to shift our engagement in the world, it's going to require a shift in the stories that we tell ourselves, the stories we allow ourselves to hear from other people, and just how we engage with story in general.
I think that's true. And, you know, it was interesting. I didn't really understand this when I was putting the class together, but it's based on the stories of people of color. And I interviewed probably 15 or 20 people and have their stories as part of the curriculum. And somebody reflected back to me what an unusual thing that was, which didn't seem unusual to me, but I think in the in the larger scope of looking at these issues, maybe it is unusual to spend an hour listening to somebody simply tell their story and really opening space for that recording to be heard and responded back to. You know, I think that that's an important gift that we were given from the people who I interviewed who were willing to share their story, and a gift that we give back by the listening, you know, by really listening to what they have to say.
I could not agree more. And I do think that that's something we're in danger of losing because of the way we live our lives right now. It used to be that entertainment, so much of entertainment was just sitting on the porch or sitting on the stoop and telling your stories to one another. And now we are so engaged in our own personal interests or our own phones or whatever it is that's taking our attention that that is not happening anywhere near as much as it used to. And I think that that's a loss. And I think it's something that we need to pay attention to because that's where we develop empathy. That's where we develop compassion, is in hearing other people's stories. And when we don't, it's very easy to think that our story is true for everybody. And that's never the case. And that actually, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think it's very easy online to create gated communities for ourselves.
Yes.
And not go beyond that boundary. And there is some good news about that. I can get targeted information, but there's some bad news about that as well.
Yeah, it limits the scope of what we're hearing. I mean, one of the things that I recognized in the 2016 election, the outcome of which shockingly or horrifyingly did not surprise me at all, was that we hadn't been listening to the people who voted for Trump. And that because we hadn't been listening, we didn't understand their pain, we didn't understand their frustration, and it came as a surprise. But it didn't surprise me. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things I believe is that the minority always knows more about the majority than vice versa.
Sure.
Because it's simply a matter of survival and safety. So I, as a Black woman, was paying more attention to what the white people around me here in Savannah, Georgia, or just online were saying. And I wasn't surprised, but it was a real teaching moment, I think, for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I think it was an important moment.
Well, and I think you could take it back to story. I think, traditionally the Republicans have had a stronger narrative.
Absolutely.
Than Democrats. And I think that's what we saw play out and is continuing to play out now. So this focus on story, I think, has been powerful for them.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the places that I really encountered story was in your book, The Geography of Loss, which I found powerful and moving and sometimes very painful to read. And as I was going through it again, I started to think about the different kinds of loss that we experience in a larger sense. Because most often I think we think of loss as the loss of a person in our lives or a specific thing. But when I was revisiting the book, I thought, but loss isn't just confined to people. And that one of the challenges that we here in the United States in particular are facing as we work to dismantle systemic racism and the patriarchal system is that there is an enormous loss on the other side for those who have benefited from that privilege that those systems provide. Mm-hmm. And those people who have benefited or feel they have benefited, because I don't always agree that they actually have in the way they think they have, they're hanging on for dear life because the idea that that would be taken away from them feels like an enormous loss. And I'd love to hear what you think about that.
Yeah, I think, I love your distinction about whether they've benefited or not. I think they've benefited with a cost, a great, great cost, and don't see that cost. You know, it's not visible to them what that cost is. But I think that's what we saw in the lead up to the election and since the election is this grasping onto something that was make America great again. Well, for whom, and when? And so there are some simplistic things that have taken place in terms of people's response to loss. And when we respond to loss, a lot of times there's anger. That's one of the things that comes up for us. And so what I tried to do in that book is say, not only are there a lot of different kinds of loss, betrayal is a loss, the end of a relationship, the loss of a job, you know, our country losing its mind. but that there are all kinds of loss that usually what our response to loss is to grab on tighter.
Yes.
And a friend of mine from Israel once told me his commanding officer took him out to the beach. And this is not a new image, but it was so striking coming from him that he said, you know, pick up two handfuls of sand and leave one palm open and squeeze the other one and tell me which one has more sand. And of course, the one that you squeeze, all the sand has been squeezed out of it. And so I think that grasping is the part where we're witnessing right now. You know, this move back, move toward an earlier time when mm-hmm. it was clearer that white people, for example, were privileged in a way that now a lot of people say I'm not privileged, you know, even if they're white. So I think that the loss is the thing that's driving the narrative right now. And all the ways in which we as human beings respond to loss. If you think about the loss even of a loved one, there are some pretty predictable ways that we respond to that. We're seeing that play out on a national stage.
Yeah, I think we really are. And it makes me think about how one of the things I've always had a problem with in our education system is that it doesn't teach us how to deal with loss. It doesn't teach us how to deal with death. Everything that we're taught is about kind of acquiring more things, but not recognizing that that's not the whole picture. At the same time that we're acquiring things, other things are going away, whether we want them to or not. Mm-hmm. It's just the nature of it. And so we get to adulthood, and I think we often have this idea in our head that we should just be able to have everything we've ever had forever and ever and ever, and then keep adding on as much as we want.
Yeah. And
so we have these enormous houses with all of the stuff we've had since we were 2 years old, and mm-hmm. we have, you know, an idea of that I think is very, very damaging and painful in a way, because there's a lot of fear that gets tied up in that idea of not being willing to let go.
Right. I do a project every fall from August 16th through the end of the year that's called Project 137. That's 137 days till the end of the year. And in it, we look at three things. One, something to think about. Two, something to create. And the last one is letting go. And it's letting go of the stuff, and it's letting go of mindsets, and it's letting go of this day. And I think we have to build the capacity to let go. I have a quote from Buddha tattooed on my arm: "How well did you love? How fully did you live? And how deeply did you let go?"
And I think that's beautiful.
I think the last one that I would add is: did you make a difference? You know.
Mm-hmm.
But the letting go is the most difficult one for people. And I think it's, you know, back to our conversation about systems thinking and systems change. We're, in addition to not being taught how to deal with loss or how to balance a checkbook, we are also not shown really healthy models of how to deal with change. So it's no wonder that we don't have the capacity on a national level to deal with the kind of change that Obama represented, for example, and hence the pendulum comes
yes.
back, you know?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it was always amusing to me when people said, well, we've elected a black president, so that means that racism is basically dead in this country. And I mean, sometimes it was all I could do not to actually laugh in someone's face when they said
that. I did laugh.
Just
you're like, nicer than I am. But I think
everyone
in this country should have to take logic classes. You know,
yes.
I think that is supremely missing in how we educate kids and adults. You know, do you have the capacity to make a logical argument about something? And that shows that we don't.
Yeah, it completely does. And it was funny that you say that, because the one thing my parents said to me growing up, and when I was off to college, my dad in particular said to me, I don't care what you study in college, just learn how to think. And part of me was slightly offended that he didn't think I already knew how to think. But you know, I was able to step back and appreciate what he was saying. And I am so grateful for that wisdom now, because it did shape how I engaged in college. And yeah. It made me take classes I probably otherwise would not have taken. And it's something that I think is very important, just to be able to make a logical, reasoned argument. And it also takes the emotion out of it. Yeah. So then we can have a conversation with someone with whom we deeply disagree without it becoming a shouting match or a slugfest.
Right.
And that's the space that logic fills, is that passionate space where we otherwise might get ourselves into trouble. So yeah, I really appreciate that you said that. So we have a little time left, and I want to cover a couple of other things. So the first thing I want to ask you about is, your son is transgender and autistic, and you said that this has been such a learning experience for you. And I would like to hear about what it's been like navigating those worlds, what you've learned from navigating that, those changes and those challenges.
What a great question. You know, in terms of having autism, what has become really clear to me is that what I see of other people out in the world is not necessarily, my interpretation of it is not necessarily what's going on. So, for example, I took Felix out to a birthday party at an ice cream shop, and he had a meltdown, which is pretty common for kids with autism, had a meltdown, and it was a pretty violent one. I was there by myself with him. And as I took him out to the car, I'm trying to hold him. He's screaming and kicking and trying to get loose. And people started calling 911 because I think they thought I was kidnapping this child from this party. Now, on the one hand, I'm glad that people feel engaged and want to help in a situation like that. On the other hand, you know, it's embarrassing as a parent to have 911 called on you.
Yeah, a little bit.
And what I recognized was, when I see kids who are having meltdowns, you know, my first thought, like everyone else, is here's a kid who's spoiled, who's having a temper tantrum because they're not getting the candy bar that they want or whatever in the grocery store. So even having done this work for a long time, it's an added reminder for me to step back from my own interpretive language and my own evaluation of what's going on. And for the most part, simply offer help, you know, simply walk toward the situation and say, this looks really hard. Is there anything I can do to help you? So there's certainly a different kind of empathy that has come as a result of that experience. In terms of being transgender, you know, this is such a hot topic, and I live in North Carolina, and North Carolina is not very friendly to people who are transgender. So when Felix made his social transition when he was 11 and was not in school, but then went back to middle school, and I thought, what chances do we have of having a good experience with an autistic transgender kid in middle school in the middle of cow fields? You know, basically, we just drive through cow fields to get to the school. And we went to the school for the first time, and the principal had printed out a gender plan from the internet. And we went through that gender plan, and it just asked these questions about the things that you need to know. Like, of course, everybody wants to know which bathroom, you know, to use. And I thought, I need to stop my own stereotyping of people and my belief that this is going to be hard, and allow people to surprise me. You know, I really allow this school to surprise me, the principal to surprise me, the people around me, the capacity of our extended family to acknowledge and accept the situation. I think it's easy because we know what the pitfalls are. We know where the hard places are going to be. It's easy to say, well, this is going to be so hard. And I don't want myself or my son or anybody in my family to live in anticipation of horror, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's helped me reshape and reframe what I believe other human beings are capable of, because I think we're capable of a lot more. I also think we raise ourselves to the level of the expectations around us. So if I expect you to accept this and be joyous about it, then the chances are greater that you will be than if I think otherwise. So I think that has been a real lesson for me as well. I have to tell you this, Felix was in the grocery store recently and I was down the aisle, not right at him. And there was an old man looking at him and I could tell, you know, the question is coming. And the old man finally said, "Are you a girl or are you a boy?" And Felix just looked at him and said, "Yes."
Oh.
And I thought, what a fantastic answer.
What a perfect answer.
Yeah. And for anybody who, you know, the preponderance of transgender in the autistic community is way higher. And I think one of the reasons for that is autistic kids and adults don't live by the measurements of other people. And so he doesn't care.
Right.
Staring at him. He doesn't, you know. So I think that that's both, it's a gift in a lot of ways.
I have to tell you, when you spoke about allowing people to surprise you, mm-hmm. I literally melted in my chair. Mm-hmm. It was just so lovely to hear those words, because I think we often do not do that. And if mm-hmm. we would just open ourselves to being surprised by people, yeah. that we would move through the world with a lot more lightness, a lot mm-hmm. less angst. That was just beautiful. Thank you so much for that. It feels like a gift. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
So my last question for you is this. I would love for you to tell us about your business, Strong Offer, and where the focus of your life is right now in your work life.
What a big question that is. I'm sorry.
Okay.
No, let me
take a piece of it.
I will. I want to get back to writing. It's been 4 years since I've written my last book, which was The Geography of Loss. And there are so many things that have pointed me in the direction of writing about this journey with Felix for a lot of reasons. Because I think one reason is that the lessons that I've learned from this experience are not only parenting lessons, they're really lessons about leadership, and they're lessons about activism and a lot of other areas of life. So I'm trying to continue the work that I do in organizations around diversity and inclusion work, because I think that's important. I want to deepen the offerings of the online School of Inclusion and Activism, but I want to carve out some more time for myself for writing. And I have found often in my life as an entrepreneur, I've been working for myself for 22 years now, that if I have a balance between consulting and training / speaking and writing, that's where I am the healthiest, because each one of those things drives the other.
Mm-hmm.
So my 2019 goal is to continue the things that I'm working on, but also carve out time from each one of them so that I have a nice block for writing my next book.
That's great. I love that, because I do think that it's easy to get enmeshed in the outward things that are important, but are not necessarily as sustaining as doing some of the things that feel mm-hmm. really integral to you. And you're a writer, you know, you are a writer. That's got to feed you in a way that none of the other things does.
It does. And I've missed it. I've really missed it. So I'm ready to get back to that.
Well, that's great, because that means that there will be another book that will be coming out that I can read. And that is really exciting. So I'm very happy to hear that. This has been so delightful. I can't even tell you. I'm so glad that we had this opportunity to talk, Patty. It's mm-hmm. just really been a pleasure.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me too. I've really enjoyed the meeting you and seeing you on Twitter and having the conversation today. It feels great.
So thank you. So thank you all for joining me for this episode of Stepping Into Truth. If you enjoyed this, please rate it. Positive ratings help expand the reach of this podcast. I will be back with another episode very soon. And until then, remember that change starts with story, so keep sharing yours.